the parent's perspective. "That looks like a toy store," exclaimed Nikki, pointing to the high chair in her friend Melanie's kitchen. "Up we go." Melanie hoisted 16-month-old Benji into the high chair for his lunch. She looked up at Nikki. "Short of nailing him to the seat, we had to think of something just to keep him sitting down to eat." "Do you have to do all that open your mouth and here comes the choo-choo stuff?" Nikki asked, half-joking. "Nah, I just give him a little of everything we're having, complete with refills," Melanie laughed. "Sometimes his table manners are a bit of a turnoff. Wonder if mashed peas in your hair make a good conditioner." From a parent's perspective, what should we know about feeding and toilet training? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Once again, we're happy to welcome our guests who are internationally recognized experts on feeding and toilet training and just about everything else you can think of when it comes to raising children. Dr. T. Barry Brazelton is Clinical Professor of Pediatrics Emeritus at Harvard Medical School and Professor of Psychiatry and Human Development at Brown University. Having dedicated his life to helping children and their parents, he established Touch Points Centers in more than 42 communities in 22 states. A famed advocate for children and their parents, he has written books that have encouraged and sustained parents through their child rearing for several generations. In 2002, Dr. Brazelton received the World of Children Award, akin to a Nobel Prize for child advocacy. Dr. Brazelton has 4 grown children and 6 grandchildren. Welcome back to Parents Perspective, Dr.
Thank
Brazelton.
You. Fun to see you guys again.
Dr. Joshua Sparrow is Dr. Brazelton's close colleague in the National and International Touchpoints programs. A child, adolescent, and general psychiatrist, he is senior consultant for inpatient psychiatry at Children's Hospital in Boston, on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, and associate director of the Brazelton Touchpoints Center. Dr. Sparrow authors a New York Times Syndicate column, Families Today, and lectures extensively in many different countries on child and adolescent development. He has 2 teenage children, a son and a daughter. We're so happy to have you back with us, Dr.
Sparrow. It's so nice of you to have us back. Thank you.
What's the most common mistake parents make with babies with regard to feeding them?
I guess being worried about whether they're eating or not, because a baby tells you so clearly when they're ready to eat. And I guess parents confuse their behavior with the language that they're trying to tell you, because a lot of times they just want to be picked up and loved. And instead they get fed, put back down again. So I think I would like for parents to learn the child's behavior right from the first and trust it, trust themselves in the process. I think they love to pick up food when they get to the point of having the pincer grasp at around 8 months, and they just love picking it up and feeding themselves unless somebody's pushing it at them. And then, of course, they lose interest because the pressure on them takes away the excitement.
I'm thinking of the time when you are still using a spoon for them and they're still opening their mouths.
And they keep opening.
give them little bits to pick up and feed them their slop. With.
Sounds so
right
appetizing. What are the critical issues, would you guys say, for feeding babies?
Well, there's the choice between breastfeeding and bottle feeding, which many families begin thinking about before the baby is even here. And you have a story about how people are beginning to move away from breastfeeding because of the challenges of going back to work.
I think a lot of women today who know they're going back to work start grieving about having to give their baby up to somebody else to nurture. And so they just don't think of going to the breast. And even though you tell them, well, we can get the breastfeeding going and you can still pick that baby up at the end of the day and love it and enjoy that suck, 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 pause, suck, 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 pause, look down and say, there you are, and I'm back with you. They start weeping at that point, and you can see that they're grieving about giving up this very precious interaction with their baby in pregnancy because they're already grieving about going back to work.
It almost sounds like we need to start advocating once again for workplace flexibility for mothers.
That's right. That would help a lot.
Right. There are many workplaces where there is no place to pump or to breastfeed. There still are many where it's just not accepted.
Encourage them to pump and feel good about it.
In order to encourage women to breastfeed, the advantages of breast milk over formula have been explained for many years, including the antibodies that you just can't put into formula, as well as the digestive enzymes that help digest food that are in breast milk and not in formula. And it also looks as if, although there's less iron in breast milk, it's easier to absorb whatever iron a baby is getting when they're fed on breast milk. But there are a couple of things that are harder to ensure a baby gets somewhere around 4 to 6 months. One of them is vitamin D, which formulas are usually fortified with, but which you might have to supplement. You have to talk to your pediatrician about that if you're breastfeeding. And another is iron, which is why somewhere between 4 and 6 months people will start breastfed children on either a supplement under their pediatrician's guidance or some gentle solid foods.
You know, that's a very critical time, that 4 to 5 months, because it just at that point, a baby does what I call a touch point, regresses and won't learn about his world. And feeding becomes difficult at that point for about 3 or 4 days. And if a mother's allowed to, she can think this is a time to wean him. And so you have to be there to talk about using supplements in some other way.
Right. And I think once you start talking about supplements, people begin to question the value of breastfeeding. And of course, milk is the main source of nutrition for infants through the first year of life, at least. And throughout that period, breast milk is really the best form, as long as these additional sources can be offered for vitamin D and iron. The reason why iron isn't a problem before is because up until about 4 months, the baby has the mother's iron stores still in their body. And after about 4 months, they need to take it in from outside. Another critical issue arises from the low-fat craze, which led many families to get rid of whole milk entirely from their diets, including the diets of their children. And suddenly, pediatricians discovered that even children under the age of 2 or 3 were being given skim milk when, in fact, they need the fat in whole milk to myelinize their brain cells, to put this coating on their brain cells, which is really critical to brain development. And so that's another critical issue, is to be sure that in the first couple of years, children are getting whole milk and not skim milk.
But there are a couple of other what I call touch points that I think parents ought to be aware of at 7 months, when they start wanting to use their new pincer grass to pick up little bits of soft foods and feed themselves. If you keep on trying to shove a spoon at them or a cup, they act like they'll shake their heads and spit it out. And if you let them have their own heads, and this is the first time that it really becomes critical that a parent begins to pay attention to the fact that feeding has got to be at the mercy of the child, not anything they may want to happen. And so they have to start making compromises way back there.
And it's interesting, I guess, if a child gets enough vitamin supplements or whatever, you don't have to worry that the child has had so much of this and so much of that. I think parents get worried about nutritional intake and amount per day.
Well, the bottom line is the well child care visit at the pediatrician's, where the child's head circumference and weight and length should be measured each time. And as long as the child is continuing to stay on their curve, that's a lot of reassurance that what they're getting is enough. So when parents are worried, they need to go to their pediatrician and make sure that they're staying on top of their growth.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on feeding and toilet training with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow about feeding and toilet training.
Well, I think parents, by a year anyway, when kids all get negative, all get to the stage of not wanting anything their parents want them to do, all through the second year, need some reassurance that there are just a few things that are absolutely critical to their future development. One is a pint of milk and its equivalent, and you say it ought to be
whole milk. For sure.
What about 2% if they're drinking lots of milk?
I think in the first 2 years, whole milk is fine. If there's already a weight issue, then a pediatrician might advise them to cut back.
But some kids drink two quarts a day. Wouldn't that be all right to have 2% milk on that?
Might be okay.
We'll get back to you.
Get him to move. He sits there looking like he knows the world.
What about food issues with toddlers? When my kids were toddlers, they woke up very early in the morning. Luckily, I'm a morning person. And 5:30 in the morning in the dark in the Boston area, I remember sitting at the kitchen table putting the Cheerios on the high chair tray so they could, you know, eat. And they ate and they played and they were very happy early in the morning. But I didn't know whether I should have been doing something else or just getting up at 5:30 and giving them breakfast.
Sounds great. Have they grown up?
They made it.
Then you both made it.
Well, once they have the pincer grasp somewhere around 8 or 9 months and they can pick up little bits of food by themselves, they really want to use this new skill. It's so exciting to have that kind of fine motor control over the world. So what you can do is give them one spoon to hold in one hand and then another spoon to hold in another hand.
And then
you can feed them their stuff.
You've got to pass it, but also tie them down to the chair.
That's right. Actually, that was your suggestion. Though.
In the second year, a toddler shows his stripes and he says, "I'm in control." And they are. And this is what parents ought to pay attention to. It made me, in my own practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts, decide that there were only 4 things that a child really needed to get through the whole second year. And so I've had lots of kids over the years that have gotten through on these. And it was a pint of milk and 2 ounces of iron-containing protein, like meat or an egg, and a little bit of fresh fruit, and a multivitamin, which covered the vitamin requirements. But I didn't know about iron. Should I have added iron?
Well, many vitamins now have iron in them, but if they're really taking their meat, you might not have to.
Yeah, or a beaten up egg or whatever.
A nutritionist once told us that there are certain things that the body retains over a long period of time. So the parents who are tearing their hair out because the kid won't eat any vegetables, you know, evidently you can keep vitamin A in your body a long time. I forget how long.
And you can also supplement. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it may be that some of the nutrients in vegetables are more bioavailable and really are preferable in vegetables. But the reality is that if you're not going to get them into your 18-month-old or your 2.5-year-old, the more of an issue you make, the worse it's going to get. They have control over their bodies and their mouths, and you can't force food into them. You just can't.
Somebody once said that if you said to a kid, "Well, first you have to eat your cookies and then you'll get your peas," that it would be a totally different feeling.
You know, that's true. And once you turn it around, kids, they go with you.
Well, I do think that we bring a lot of our own prejudices about foods to kids, and we make assumptions that they won't like this or we won't like that. And then when we introduce it, it's with trepidation. And I'm sure that they pick up on it and get turned off. And so I actually disagree a little about all children not liking vegetables. Dr. B happens to hate vegetables.
And never he grew eats up just fine. Now.
And he grew up
like
just
black
fine. Yeah. I bet she had to grow into that.
First.
But she had to grow into that. But I do think that if there is no thing about vegetables, that it may be that kids are more likely to accept them. It's also true that many children do not accept new tastes very quickly. And so you have to introduce a new taste somewhere between 5 and 15 times before it's familiar. But introducing it doesn't mean force feeding it. It means just putting it on their plate and letting them inspect it and not making any kind of deal out of it. And then by the 15th time, it's familiar and an old friend, and then they may try it. And then there are other children who have hypersensitive tastes, and that softens over time. But parents may become fearful and react to where their development is of their taste buds at age 2 and then discover at 5 that it's not a problem anymore, and they actually can. In fact, recently a woman came to my office and said, "You know, I ate a banana for the first time at age 40.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's the vegetable thing. I ate the first vegetables at age 40.
I remember when my kids went to college, they came home with very different tastes. They were now eating things like salads. I almost fell off my chair. So I guess as we go through life, we have periods where we
Well, it's genetically determined, the way we experience taste. And different people experience taste tastes differently on the basis of their genes. And some people are very sensitive to some tastes, and that's part of the basis for being a picky eater. And then over time, there's some maturation where it's a little bit less intense or a little bit less disturbing.
I've never heard that. That's brand new to me.
It's absolutely true. And you can sort of, you can figure out what kind of genes somebody has by giving them a specific chemical essence and seeing whether or not they can taste it or not. And you go around a room and there'll be a couple of people who just can't stand it and everybody else who finds it completely benign or can't even taste it.
What a great parlor game. Remind us.
But that's part of what you're doing with picky eating in the early years. It's discovering whether or not you've got a child who really does have the sensitivity.
Out for, as genetic rather than cultural, because it's, I always thought it was cultural.
So
did I. They got introduced so early.
Well, the way you determine anything else being genetic, you look at family studies and twin studies.
We knew somebody whose family came from Southeast Asia, Thailand, and I once asked her, well, what do you do with the highly spiced foods when the kids are very little? She said, oh, we give them very mild tasting stuff until they're whatever age. And I thought, wow, you know, it must
be
all over the world.
I've done some work in Thailand, and they ask for the spicy foods very very soon. By the end of the first year, they ask their mothers for spicy foods that the adults are eating. So there's a lot of modeling and identification with the adults that goes on that we don't pay any attention to because we're so hooked on what they ought to be having.
And presumably they're introduced to some of these novel tastes through the breast milk before they're taking any solids.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Yeah.
One of the things we haven't touched on is childhood obesity, which is now rearing its head big time. What should we tell parents?
Obesity is an epidemic in our country, and I think we know more about how to prevent it than what to do about it once it is struck. Obesity is also, in part, genetic, so that we certainly have no right to blame children or parents who are struggling with obesity when that's been what they've inherited as their way of metabolizing. But still, even for people who are genetically predisposed to be obese, there's plenty that can be done to prevent it. And
I would think in a family where there was obesity genetically, you'd want even more preventive approach.
That's right. And often what is forgotten is activity. People think a lot about nutrition, but forget that you really can't lose weight unless you're burning enough calories, and you don't burn enough calories if you don't move. And then I think we set up, when we do think about it, activity programs for people who are overweight that are just terribly boring. There's no motivation. There's no hope that it's really going to do any good. And people give up. I think we have to set up programs that really do it by step, and with children, turn it into something fun that's a game that engages them, and get rid of all of the guilt about not having done it today or not having gotten as far as we'd push them to go. I think with children, and we talk about this in the book on feeding, the critical thing is to listen to what it is about their being overweight that bothers them and then offer to work on that with them.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on feeding and toilet training with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow about feeding and toilet training.
You know, I think Weight Watchers in adults is one model that we ought to pay attention to. They get reinforcement from each other. And if we got a bunch of kids together that were all genetically predetermined to be overweight.
Or not. Just struggling with the same issue. I think you're right. The supportive.
They would support each other.
Yeah.
And they'd find activities that would be fun with each other.
Right. And I think in terms of prevention, certainly not watching more than an hour a day of television as per the American Academy of Pediatrics, because that just breeds inactivity. And to never eat while you're watching TV. Do not have a TV in your kitchen. For infants, as we were saying earlier, to really look at the infant's signals of being full and to respect those and to help cultivate those in the infant so that we're not offering a child the breast or the bottle when, in fact, they just want to be held or they just want to be cuddled or they just want to be entertained so that they can really learn for themselves when they're full.
Well, junk food really kills off this satiation hormone that lets people know when they're full. So junk food is really the problem, and that's what kids get exposed to on television and the media.
And then there's junk food in the schools. We have to get the junk food out of the schools. You know, many schools strapped with budget cuts have agreed to take in junk food and vending machines from some of the big companies, and that's just, I mean, how can we do that to our children, feeding them with garbage, essentially, and then have this national health crisis? And it's not just obesity. It's all of the illnesses that obesity is likely to lead to, like diabetes and high blood pressure and cardiac problems, among others.
And we're doing it to ourselves as grown-ups. It's easier to grab a donut than to make a salad.
Not only easier, but a lot more fun.
Well, we haven't hit on toilet training at all, which we want to do. Why has that become such a major event in our society?
You know, I think it's kind of interesting. I think it's partly because it really is a major event for children. There really is a sense of this being important and an accomplishment, and I think that we do pick up on that. But Dr. Breslin has also taught me a lot about how in other cultures over time, where our physical relationships to our children and to our environment were different, and so that toilet training could be transacted completely differently. Why don't you tell the story about how in southern Mexico, children are trained so early because they're in such close contact physically with their mothers?
The mothers carry them around in the serape all day long, and so they feel the gut start acting. And the second they do, they hold the baby out. So he has his BM or his urine outside, and by a year, these kids are ready when they start walking, which they do on time, to go outside to do these things because that's all they've been exposed to for the whole year. That would be a little bit artificial for here, but it certainly worked down there. It made you wonder, you know, is toilet training really something we superimpose on kids? And I think it is. I think it's something we ask them to do in order to grow up and be like us. And so as a superimposed request, we ought to take it very seriously from the child's standpoint. How do we get them to want to do it? And I think when parents begin to push because they feel under the pressure of, you know, going to nursery school or whatever is increased these days, they feel like, oh, I've got to get my kid trained or he'll grow up and go to college untrained. And, you know, these are such non-child-oriented ideas. We ought to leave it to the child, and it's so easy to do when you introduce it correctly.
How can parents guard against becoming overwhelmed with trying to instill these skills in their children?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that parents might do is turn their attention to the other exciting events in their children's development, because one of the reasons why this has become heightened and overemphasized is because so many parents work and miss their child's first step, their child's first word, and so toilet training becomes another opportunity to be able to celebrate the child's growth. And yet there's so many other things that we could be excited about if only our attention were drawn to them, as in the touch points of development. For example, when a child develops object permanence, which is the capacity to hold a picture in their head of something even when they can't see it, why not get as excited about that as when they sleep through the night without wetting for the first time? Or learning how to play symbolically, when a child begins to use a toy not just to bang or to throw or to mouth, but to use it for what it represents as a symbol. Why not get as excited about that as when they're able to sit on the potty?
Are you equating BMs with these toys?
Well, I think, what does that mean?
Not
BMs, but toilet training really is this major accomplishment for the child, but we may get overwhelmed if we see it as sort of the measure of who this child is going to be, of their potential, of their intelligence. And there are so many other signs that we can see to reassure ourselves about how our children's development is progressing.
Well, I sort of liked your idea of object permanence with a BM.
Oh, well, it is connected, for sure.
Kids wonder, where the hell has my BM gone all my life? And they don't know.
And that's why you should never flush their BM down the toilet
that's
until
right.
they're ready.
Let them enjoy it.
And when they're ready, because they can hold an image of their lovely BM in their head until,
until it needs to go.
And beyond.
I remember the children being unhappy that we were going to have to empty the potty.
Well, it's like a part of their body that's gone forever, especially if they don't have object permanence and they can't imagine that it still exists somewhere. I've done some therapy with children where we spent many, many sessions drawing pictures of toilets and poop and watched the poop go through the toilet to the pipes, into the gutter, into the ocean, and then the water evaporating from flowers.
Because we had a great big toilet in Boston at the Children's Museum, and these kids, 9 and 10 years old, would line up for blocks to find out where their BMs had been going all this time.
Oh, tell a story about your friend the astronaut.
Do we have time?
Oh, you've got to tell the story.
Well, I was on Mr. Rogers, and he had Buzz Aldrin on, and the kids could ask Buzz Aldrin anything they wanted about space. And so these kids were so thrilled to meet him. And so they said, Mr. Aldrin, do you get scared when you go in space? Oh, I used to, but I don't anymore. Does your mommy get scared when you go up in space? Well, she still does. Mr. Aldrin, where does your BM go in space? And he turned absolutely beet red and couldn't answer. He didn't know where his BM went.
Oh, no.
That was the most wonderful thing.
That is such a great child question, you know.
All these
are
kids.
Things that are important for them to know.
Isn't
that and we don't realize how important it is to them.
That's so funny. Well, it's interesting because in Washington, D.C., when you go visit the, I forget which space vehicle they have, but they do show what happens with the toileting.
There's
facility.
A little shrine for poop and stuff.
I bet this came from Mr. Rogers' show. That where their PMs are gone.
Besides your new books, which are Feeding Your Child and Toilet Training Your Child, both of them The Brazelton Way, two more additions to the collection of these small, easy-to-use books, what resources would you suggest for listeners who want to learn even more?
Well, there is a videotape on toilet training that Dr. Brazelton did, and I think it's available through Consumer Vision, and they're probably on the internet at consumervision.com. There's also, for people who want more medical information, there's the Children's Hospital Guide.
That's a very good one. I think that's a big one, isn't that right?
It covers almost everything, including smearing. Well, that's gone out the window. You know, most things except holding back BMs have gone out the window since I started practicing pediatrics because we've taken pressure off kids. And now the pressure's coming back. And they're beginning to hold back their BMs and hold back urine and so forth. So we've really got to pay attention to this and take the pressure off children. Let them tell us when they're ready.
Well, on that happy note, we want to thank both of you, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow, again for coming in and being with us and letting all of us be the beneficiaries of your insights and wisdom.
It's so great to talk with you again.
It's fun to see both of you again.
Thanks. Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Dr. Brazelton and Dr. Sparrow's book, Toilet Training Your Child the Brazelton Way, or Feeding Your Child the Brazelton Way. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And mention show number 219. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Dr. Brazelton and Dr. Sparrow's books are part of a series, and they're all available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.